I think your poem was perfect. Lauren, I love it when a plan comes together. Hey, I just happened to hear His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, was talking this morning about how we need intellect as human beings. It makes us different than most animals because we have this intelligence, he called it. We have this capacity for intelligence and how important it is. But then he was saying that intelligence alone doesn't really work in our social environment, and that what we need is warm-heartedness. And most animals that are social, you know, like they need to move in a pack, they have a lot of warm-heartedness naturally around the pack that they move with. And we're the only sort of species that can have intelligence, but we can actually strip away our warm-heartedness. Or we judge it as having something to do with religion, and I don't like that. And so this opening that I heard what you were pointing to, Lauren, I think it's going to tie in nicely with what I wanted to talk about this morning about boundaries. So for those of you that were here last week, this is going to be a little bit of a review because some of you weren't here last week. And last week, so I think about boundaries in two ways, one in the body and one in the mind. So in the body, learning how to feel our way through life instead of always using our mind or our intellect. It is the warm-hearted side. It is the body's allowing us to be more open. And so our practice makes us more sensitive, and the more sensitive we get, the more we can feel when things are a little off, feel when harm is a present, feel when I'm not really being kind or I'm too graspy, too indulgent in something, and we can use that as a boundary to pull back a little and settle ourselves more into the present moment. It's the felt sense of that, and it is the getting used to vulnerability as a gateway to help us begin to see that there's a huge possibility that there's a whole world out there that does not have to be judged so much by our minds. And today, I want to talk about the mind as a boundary. And we don't always think of the mind as a boundary because it can be a little testy for us. But I want to give you, I want to share a clip with you. You know I love clips. For those of you that don't, I love them. We used to read stories, but we don't have any kids anymore. They were like sick of Zoom at school all day, so we don't have them anymore. So now we got to do clips. And so I have a little clip that I'm going to share that I think it's a famous Zen story. But I like the way this guy does it, and I think it'll help us kind of see what I'm talking about as we go along.
Man was waiting at an airport for a long-distance flight. His flight was delayed, and so he had a little spare time. He saw a deal on some cookies and thought he should treat himself. He bought quite a few cookies because he thought it might be quite a long delay. He took a seat near a man and started to read the magazine he also picked up earlier. He exchanged a glance with the other man and then tried to avoid eye contact as he went back to reading. While he was engrossed in his magazine, he happened to see that the man sitting beside him boldly grabbed a cookie from the container. He initially ignored the incident to avoid a scene. He grabbed a cookie himself and went back to his magazine. But the man seemed to have enjoyed the cookie so much, he took another one and started eating it too. This continued for a while, and with each passing moment, he began to get more and more irritated. Every time he took a cookie, so did the other man. When the last cookie was left, the man nervously took that cookie and broke it in half. He offered the other to the man and smiled. The man took the cookie and could not believe the other man's nerve. He was thinking in his head, how ungrateful could that man be? The other man then left and took the container with him. This guy couldn't believe what had just happened. He was relieved when his flight was called. He gathered his belongings. As he lifted his bag, he saw that there was a full container of cookies right there. He was totally shocked, totally surprised. It caught him off guard. He thought to himself, if my cookies are here, then wait, those cookies were his. The other man had shared his cookies whilst he was thinking he was the one doing the sharing. Whilst he was angry and irritated, the other man was being generous and kind. He felt so bad for what had happened, but he couldn't find the other man anywhere and didn't know how to apologize. Things are not always as they appear. Sometimes we make quick assumptions about people, circumstances, and situations. We judge them, label them, and put them into a box, not recognizing that there is a much bigger picture. Sometimes we meet someone in a particular state, stage, or phase of their life and stereotype them to be a certain way. Don't be so quick to judge. You never know when you might find yourself walking in someone else's shoes. And remember, the best apology is changed behavior.
Yeah, is that nice? So touchy. This is exactly what I wanted to point to when we left off last week about the body. It is in the knowing of harm, kindness, and this restraint, the knowing of it. And one of the best ways to know is to double check our feeling tones. Because we don't really often practice with feeling tones as a big deal. We just stay with the breath all the time. Like, this is all about the breath meditation. But feeling tones is another way that I think bridges between the body and emotions and thought. So feeling tones are both felt in the body and they are known in the mind. And the reason why I'm pointing to feeling tones is because instead of following what he was thinking, if he had double checked his feeling tones and began to question whether or not somebody would just start eating your cookies out of the blue, just looked at it. I mean, the container was all, he didn't open the container. He just took a cookie out of the container. It was already open. That ought to tell you something right there. But there's a way in which we follow our mind as if the intellect itself, this intelligence that we have, is speaking the truth. It is speaking the truth from our intellectual's understanding. So the mind thought this guy was taking his cookie because it looks the same. Same container, same cookies. It looks the same. Those are mine. And the mind does not know gray. It does not understand the nebulous. It only sees in black and white, right or wrong, good or bad, this or that. That's all it sees. So when we have this practice, what we are looking for are signs that we need to question the mind. They are boundaries. I think of them as boundaries around our thinking. And I think there are five places where you are up against a boundary and you need to check. Or what, I used to go to a therapist and I would freak out about the smallest thing. You know, I come from trauma. Many of you know that. So anybody that's come from trauma, you know, we got a trigger point here. So the smallest thing, and that's it. This is, it's all, let's run for the hills. Everybody get out of here as quick as you can. It's over. And so my therapist used to get me to double check is what we came up with the term. I had to agree that anytime I had a thought that was like, this is bad, this is dangerous, it's not safe, I had to double check against reality. And there are five places I think we need to practice learning to double check that. First, anytime you have a preference. If you have a preference to something, you got to double check on whether or not your preference, getting your preference, being with your preference, getting your way, whatever that is, whether or not you are going against your right intentions of non-harm, being as kind as you can, and having some restraint. So if you have a preference there, it's probably leaning into greed, hatred, or delusion. And so you want to, it's not like you don't want any preferences, but you want to use the preference as a boundary to make sure you are not stepping on someone else in order to get your preference the way you want it. So the preference itself is a mental thing, but it becomes the boundary that you can practice out of. So hear me, I'm not saying we don't want preferences. We just want to use a preference as a boundary that says, or like a bell, wait a minute, am I going to harm somebody if I get this preference? Am I being as kind as I can be, or am I just plowing forward to get what I want? The second boundary is any kind of assumption. Any kind of assumption. So remember when I was saying the body is also our boundary? These mental and body go together, because the man could have just simply said, he could have said, these are my cookies. He could have said something like, excuse me, I brought those cookies for me. Even if that sounds a little, you know, like selfish, like those are not yours. Then he would have quickly learned that those were his, and he was eating the man's cookies, trying to eat some cookies. He wasn't really getting the mind's assumption. He was just following that assumption. And you can so clearly see how our clinging to the assumption of that is mine created all of his suffering. In fact, it created the suffering he felt after he realized he was wrong. You know, that's when we feel like, oh, we got to fix it. But again, the harm could have been, we can learn to practice with questioning our assumptions. So if you think someone's doing you something wrong, then you better speak up. You got to learn to speak up and speak to whatever you actually think is going on. I used to have a lot of fear. That's part of trauma, is you have a lot of fear. And one of the places that I used to have the greatest amount of fear was when I would go hiking. And one time we went hiking with a friend of mine, and we saw this bear. And, you know, we're like yelling at the bear that we're coming up the trail. So you go on your way. We're coming this way. You don't want to mess with us, and we don't want to mess with you. So you go on and don't be standing there. It was like an incline, and the bear was at the top of the incline. So we're trying to get it to go away. So, of course, the bear goes off to the left, which is the direction that we have to go. And so when the bear goes off to the left, as soon as we get to that point, there's no bear around. He doesn't want anything to do with us as much as we want to do with him. But my mind kept thinking that there was a bear and it was going to jump out and chew us all up any minute now. It's just waiting. And so rather than get caught in that catastrophic, traumatic thinking that I could get caught in for so long, I had trained myself to use the body as a double check. Let's make sure. What's going on here? So at first I was just trying to be present. You don't see a bear. If you saw a bear, then you could take off running, but you don't see a bear. But then I would hear these things rustling in the bushes. I heard a crow cawing, and it sounded like the person was saying, "Help, help, help, the bear has got them and it's coming to get us." So I could hear my mind making all these assumptions about everything it saw. And so I just started asking my friend, "Do you hear that sound?" And she'd say, "Yes, that is the rain in the trees." I'm like, "Okay, just double checking. Do you hear that sound?" "Yes, that is a crow cawing." I would just ask her. I just was double checking against my assumptions. And eventually the mind caught up with the truth of the moment, which is the bear was gone. And we just kept walking. It was a beautiful hike. And the rain cleared up and it was sun came out. It was perfect. But I know I could have spent that entire hike freaking out or turned around and left and never experienced it. So this, it's being careful with assuming your mind is telling you the truth of what's going on when it's not. The third one is our judgments. We make these judgments on everything quick. It comes from a mind that has the intellect to distinguish between what is safe for us and what is not safe for us. It comes from what Buddha called, these are all qualities in conceit, because conceit is, the comparing mind is the last defilement to leave us. Anger is gone. We're not even angry anymore, but we still are comparing and judging everybody. So we want to be careful with this judging mind. And watching our labels. Again, this guy made a label. His mind made the label on this other guy. It didn't even matter that the other guy was smiling, was pretty gentle and kind. I mean, he did not seem to be a kind of person that's just going to steal your cookies. And yet, even with all of the present moment realities looking different, we follow our judgments and not, we don't question those judgments. So the judgments, use those as boundaries. In fact, many of us, I mean, I judged a lot. We all do. But I learned to treat my judging mind as a gift, because every time I would judge something, I would have the opportunity to double check and see if my judgment was actually correct. And 99% of the time, I hate to say it, it was not. I mean, there was maybe one or twice that I was right, but yeah, my track record was pretty bad. But if you see how often your judgment is wrong, your ability to stop judging is pretty easy. But the reason why we can't stop judging is because we never question the judgment, and we don't use it as a boundary to say that we're leaning too much into the mind. That's what this boundary is. For the body, it is learning to open ourselves to be more warm-hearted. And for the mind, the boundary is learning to limit the use of our intellect and be more open to the whole situation. Both examples, whether you're in the body or in the mind, are designed to get us to be more open to what's the full picture of what's going on and not one little sliver, which is my opinion. So comparing mind is the next one. This comparing of something is better or worse or equal to, that kind of comparing in and of itself, assumptions, preferences, judgments, fixing, all of those fall within the comparing mind. But you're singling out comparing because we have a tendency to pick. This teacher at the 3-week retreat at IMS there did this great example. She showed us a leaf, And she goes, she was giving a Dhamma talk and she showed this leaf. And she goes, well, this is a pretty big leaf as far as leaf goes. And, you know, don't you think? And she asks the room and, you know, everybody, yeah, that's a pretty big leaf. Then she reaches in and she pulls out a bigger leaf. And she goes, oh, well, maybe it's not so big, you know, because in comparison to this leaf, now it doesn't look so big anymore. But then she pulls out another leaf that's even huge. So it's sort of like our minds figure some, compare and decide this is what it is. But it's only when it gets new information that it changes. So the comparing mind is the kind of mind that keeps limiting us rather than having what Lauren was pointing to, this more open-hearted way of being with experience. We want to be more open-hearted. We don't want to be tucked in, closed up, and constricted. We want to be more open and seeing more, the more diversity and nuance in all of our life experiences. And then the last one is this this fixing mind. If you find yourself wanting to fix something, let me fix that. Let me help you with that. Let me make it better. Let me do some. It's like not accepting what the moment has offered us. We want to temper that fixing mind kind of energy and be more open to allowing the mind to be, allowing the moment to offer what it wants to offer. For people who are cerebral, I guess, for lack of a better word. But it doesn't have to be. I don't want to say cerebral. No. I think almost in every profession, if you're good at it, you know how to fix problems. So if you're a mom and you're good at it, you can fix problems. If you're a administrative assistant, you're good at it, you can fix problems. If you're a doctor, you're good at it, you can fix problems. The thing that happens is when we're good at something, the mind then takes that quality and applies it to everything. So we are always trying to fix something. And actually, that trying to fix something puts too much control on us, our need to control everything and how everything is done. So the more open we are, the more we're able to let life be freer, to let it speak to us. I failed the bar. Every bar exam I took the first time in every state, and I took 3 state bars. Every time I took the bar the first time, I have to fail it. Oh my God, it would drive me crazy. And then I have to take it the second time. And then I can figure out how to do it and get through. But you would think that failing the bar, and it was to me the first time, the worst thing that could happen to me. You would think. Everybody wants to fail, pass the bar. Nobody wants to fail it. But if I look back on my life, and I would not have known this, except for looking back on my life, I am so glad I failed every one of those bar exams. Because if I had passed, what I would have done would have, in the long run, been worse. The first bar, I begged for this job. I finally got it. It was contingent on me passing the bar. And, of course, I failed it. And I beat somebody else out in the job. And he then got the job that I only had for a couple of months before I found out I failed the bar. And, of course, he passed it. So I'm trying to get my stuff out of the office, and he's bringing his stuff in. And he goes, oh, I didn't know you were going to be here. I thought you'd already be gone. I was so mad. I get all my stuff out. I mean, I'm so miserable, so mad. I got to take the bar again and look for another job. But by the time I passed the bar, the prosecutor's office had this great push for getting people of color into the prosecutor's office. And I got this really nice job on the trial team and the drug unit. My friend, he ultimately became my friend because about a year, it took about another year before I passed the bar, about a year and a half into his now cushy job, the partners, four of them, have a major breakup and they wanted to force him to pick sides. And so he, as an associate, was put in a very awkward situation and he got very ugly. Like some of the ugly divorces you've seen, he got ugly like that. So that, it was not for a year and a half that I could see that the universe was right in me not passing that bar. Even when I failed the bar here in Washington, by the time I got home, by the time I got to pass the bar, I got a much better job than I would have had. So you just don't know, just because the universe is offering you something that you don't think is right, it does not mean that it's not meant for it to be. And it doesn't mean that it's not the best thing for you in this moment. All of this is about practice. And we just use the nature of the comparing mind as a boundary to help us question our question the truth of what our mind's telling us. So the mind isn't always synced up with reality. So we got to question whether or not it's the mind we're going to follow or reality. This is what I think practice, especially for lay practitioners, this is what we're doing. So I'm going to stop now so that those of you that want to leave can leave and we still have enough time for some discussion that you can have with yourself for about 15 minutes. And I'll make out the breakout rooms. So let's see if anybody has anything they want to share.
Sean and Bruce.
Yeah, go ahead.
There we go. I come from trauma, probably not anywhere near as bad as other people's trauma, but yet I come from trauma. And will find myself in a reaction at times where I feel like I'm fighting for my life. And a lot of the time, it is a false reaction. I'm not in danger. But I'm ready to kill.
Yes.
To protect myself. And you say, go to the body. Well, my body is already on, I'm going to effing kill you.
Yes, I know.
So how can I know, like I just answered a question right there, is to catch the reaction before it occurs, possibly. But usually I don't know the reaction's happening until I'm off. And how do I feel in my body? How do I perceive whether or not I'm really in danger? Or this is just another one of those things that appear to be danger and it's not.
So this is what I'm pointing to. The feeling tones are it's the feeling tone that you're talking about. I feel unpleasant. This is wrong. That unpleasantness feels wrong. It's a feeling tone that is being generated by the mind's assumption that something bad is happening.
Yeah.
So we're in this loop. What I mean by going to the body is there are many things that we have available besides the feeling tone. We can see whether or not something is really going wrong. We can begin to ask someone if this is really as bad as I think. This feels terrible to me, but we're questioning whether or not the mind is telling us the truth. And you can usually tell the boundary that you need to start questioning is when you have that big explosive moment, that big feeling there. That's when, that's like a beacon, a boundary that says you are not thinking what is actually happening. But the only way you can find your way out of it is by using your sight, looking to see, am I in danger? Do I hear, is anything saying anything? And actually being, touching, coming into the reality. That's what your body can do for us. Because the body is the only part of you that's in reality. The rest of it is not.
Even though the body is freaking out.
Yes. The body is not freaking out. Actually.
Yeah.
I'm going to give this.
It sure feels like it.
It does. But it is the mind that's freaking out. And it is the body that's following the mind. But if you trust the body more than the mind, that is, this water's done. If you trust the body more than the mind, it's a completely different scenario.
I mean, for instance, just me talking about what I was talking about.
Yeah.
My body's shaking.
Yes, it is. Because it's like it's being exposed.
So there's some part maybe that's deeper than the freak out I'm experiencing in my body.
That's right. There is, you have the ability to discern the truth of that freak out, the truth of the moment. And the way that you have that capacity to discern it is to actually look at what's happening. So you get quiet, you look, and you say, wait, it's really quiet right here. I feel like all hell's about to break loose, but nothing's, everything is actually the same. That is, do you want this? I got it. Everything is exactly the same. Everything is safe. I'm in the same spot. There's no danger here. That's what you're looking for. That's what you're learning to see.
I hear you, but here's my confusion is that go to the body, but to me, the body is, it's almost like it's coming from the body. I feel it so strongly in the body. And you're saying it's not the body.
No, that reactivity you have is mind. Huh. It is not body. It is the body. Our bodies are symbiotic. So it follows the mind. But the body has its own wisdom separate from the mind. And that part of the body is our sense doors. It's our recognition of the truth of the moment. It knows it's in the present moment. It knows where it's at. It knows what it's doing. So your mind might think it's dangerous, but your body will know it's not.
Hmm.
You see the difference?
Not really, but I'll work with it.
That's what you... So right now, you are talking about your mind, your body, as if your body is in danger. This is the best way for me to describe it.
Yeah.
But the part of you that thinks you're in danger is the mind. It is not the body. Because if you look at your body, if you close your eyes, look at the body, it knows, not even close your eyes, that would be the worst. So keep your eyes open, but look around the house. It knows there's no danger here. It can see that. It can see there's no danger. You can ask Sean, she'll tell you, no, there's no danger, we're good. It's because you are following what the mind is telling you, and that is not reality, that the body responds this way. But there is a capacity for your body to know separately than that. Let me see these other two before we run out of time. Yeah, Lindo. Thank you so much, Bruce.
I actually am sort of following up on what Bruce said, because I had a sort of a similar kind of question. And I think for me, sometimes it feels like, it does feel like it's the body that's reacting. But it's sort of like there's the body reacting to some, like almost some subconscious assumptions in the mind. But then there can be the other part of the mind that's like thinking, well, no, you know, that's not dangerous. Nothing's going to happen. So it can get kind of confusing between the more conscious thinking part of the mind that's here now and the subconscious part of the mind that might be influenced by all sorts of stuff that happened a long time ago.
Yes, this is it. I think what is getting confusing here, I think you're helping me see this. Yes, the body is actually reacting to the trigger, but the body's reaction is based on the mind's false assumptions or the mind's old subconscious thinking. The body has its own separate wisdom that's based in the truth of reality. And that is what we want to go to. We want to sidestep the mind's overreaction and go to the body's truer connection with reality. And that's the sense doors. It's why I used to carry around little vials of essential oils, because they smelled so good and they were pleasing to me. And so even if I'd have some trigger, I would smell this smell that was softer, kinder, that would calm down the reactivity of the mind. That's what you're really trying to go against. I see, Kathy, your hand up, but there was someone else I think I missed. But go ahead, Kathy. Maybe I answered the other person.
Here. One of the things we talked about in our small group is that if you come out of trauma, you have reactions both in your mind and your body that tell you you're in danger. And that's important. And it's important to listen to that. Not that it's always right, but it's kind of like your alarm system. You've learned and you're trying to protect yourself. Something here is wrong. Something here is dangerous. And it doesn't matter in some ways whether that's coming from your body or your mind. What's important is that you pause and check it out. Now, we talked about how hard it is to pause because when something happens, it's like you feel like you have to respond right now. But you don't. You can pause and then you can check it out. You can check it out with your body and you can check it out with your mind. And see whether there is danger. What is it that makes me think I'm in danger? It's that crow that I'm hearing, and the crow sounds scary or whatever it is. But yeah. To be able to say, okay, it's not that you're always wrong.
I'm wrong. I was wrong a lot.
I hear you, but I think you're being too hard on yourself, because I think that what you don't remember are the times when you're right. When in fact, yeah, there is something dangerous here. It may not be life threatening, but there's some danger here that I'm responding to. And so I think it's important to listen to that, to listen to the wisdom of your body and your mind.
It is. I don't want you guys to hear that I'm challenging the idea of our safety mechanism. What I'm trying to say is those safety mechanisms, especially if you grew up in trauma, are warped because they're based on a small child's perception of safety, and a small child does not have the kind of safety capacity that adults have. Right. We have way more capacity to protect ourselves than a small child does. Yes. But our safety triggers are based on a child's understanding.
Yep.
And so we as adults fling way more harm and violence than the situation actually calls for, because we're operating out of a child's perspective. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that when that trigger happens, that is a sign for double checking. Not a sign that everything's cool, but a sign that you double check and see, is this reaction in rational relationship with what's actually happening?
Yep.
And then you can temper your capacity to more align with what's actually happening. But mostly we overreact, cause a whole slew of harm, and then have to backpedal all of that back. But the thing is, I'm saying stop trying to not freak out, because that freak out is a habitual response from childhood. So instead of trying to not freak out, use the freak out as a boundary that says, let me double check and see what's going on. The freak out is going to happen. But when that freak out happens, that's the double check. That's the thing that says, I need to double check here and make sure that I'm not like just triggered and it's not real. Kristen, you can get the last thing. Kristen, sorry, you can get the last thing, and then we got to stop. Otherwise, I'm going to get cut off. I'm going to have the little, you know, that little K.
Nobody cuts off to Aries.
It's coming quick.
It's like nobody puts baby in the corner. Nobody cuts off to Aries.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I was just thinking about how I've been working with this, and especially, you know, going through menopause, and I understand what, you know, the physical sensations that are created, and then trauma, and then you add everything else. But I have been working, you know, especially with my teenage daughter, to just go, look, I need a minute. And lately she's, you know, seeing it, right? The sweat's beating and I'm just overwhelmed. And I just like, yeah. I just need to take that moment. And I think that's been huge for me to just, I know that I need to listen, because a boundary has been crossed.
Yeah.
But is it that big of a deal, or is it just too many things piled on top of each other?
Yes. And we need to learn how to discern what's the boundary that's even triggered here. What is it?
It's sort of like what Kathy's. Yeah. It's not what you were talking about.
Even. No. Sometimes our trigger is just something somebody said, or some smell, or something we heard. We get triggered, and now we're lost in this place, and we want everything to get fixed before we come back to ourselves. But it doesn't have to be like that. We can use that trigger to say, oh, something has happened here, and now I'm going to look at this. I'm not doing anything out there until I figure out what's going on in here. And that capacity, it's just a skill that we learn to do as practitioners. It's not therapeutic. It's not psychologically, I don't know whether it's even psychologically sound. I just know as a practitioner, where we have our liberation is letting go of clinging. And when you're triggered, you're in a lockjaw clinging, and that's what you're going to try to loosen that clinging by giving yourself the space to not. I'm not going to freak out. No, you're always going to do that. You come from trauma. It's always going to be like that. But you can flip it and use the trauma as the sort of the key to be more open and see what's going on. Is it true that I'm in danger? Is it true that, you know, everybody's out to get me? Is it true that I need to fight? I'm being attacked. That's what you're asking yourself. Is all that true?